totally listener-supported radio station. It is 9 a.m. on a Tuesday morning, and coming up in just a moment will be Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall.
Sometimes you see that I'm mad. Don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? When everything goes wrong, you see some bad. But I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood. Sometimes, baby, I'm so carefree, with a joy that's hard to hide. And then sometimes again it seems that all I have is worry. And then you're bound to see my other side. But I'm just a soul. More than my share, but that's one thing I never mean to do, 'cause I love you. Oh, baby, I'm just human.
Good morning. Good morning. And good morning again. This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and I want to wish you all a very, very good morning. We are here for another day. We have been given this, and we will rejoice in it. We're going to continue in our series interviewing and discussing their prospects for the office of Manhattan District Attorney. And today we're going to be focused on Dan Court. But before we get to Dan Court and this discussion, we need to understand that our Manhattan District Attorney's Office is the most powerful DA office in the country. Not only does it reflect on what's happening in our borough of Manhattan, but also in the city of New York, it then influences the country, and some people say prosecutors around the world see what's happening in New York City, in the United States of America, the last standing superpower left over from the 20th century as we discuss superpowers. We need to understand that we may agree or disagree with that title, that standing, but it is what it is, based on military and economic clout and the ability to bully other countries with that military and economic clout. This is the last standing superpower from the 20th century going into the 21st century. And New York City, being the most powerful city in that superpower, then has a great deal of influence nationally and internationally. So the prosecutor's office has influence per se, and because of that, whoever becomes the DA will be influencing the rest of the country with those policies. We know that Cyrus Vance is not going to seek re-election, and that we have a pretty tight but wide open race for the office. And when we speak to Dan Court later on, we'll ask him some of the same similar questions than others to find out what his platform is and what he plans to do in the office. But in the meantime, I want us to turn to the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. This is an act that has some implications. I believe there are still many things that can be done. But if you have a chance, use that internet for more than just sending emails and, you know, of course, keeping up with certain sports events. We need to actually look at what's going on in our world. And that George Floyd Justice in Policing Act is part of criminal justice reform, national criminal justice reform. And here's another reason why we need national criminal justice reform. There are some, let's say, they call them reformist prosecutors. And in Philadelphia, for example, Austin, Texas, in Detroit. But here is the concern. Once that office ends for that particular candidate, then the next candidate comes in with their own policies. What we need is national criminal justice reform, and national criminal justice reform that looks at the racialized history of this country, takes it into account, and tries to figure out how we can address it and use that legislation not just to address that history, but figure out ways to stop people from banking, using, understanding that they have an unfair advantage based on that racial history. And let me give you a few examples, and I've talked about this before. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 states that people cannot discriminate in jobs, for example, based on race, color, religion, gender, they use the word sex, and nation of origin. So the reason why we've been able to have diversity in employment such as we have is because there are consequences to discriminating in employment. Consequences. Whereas before there were no consequences. Title IX, for example, in sports, requires that female athletes receive equal treatment, equal resources to male athletes. And because of that, you've seen the rise of female athletes. You've seen the rise of opportunities for female athletes and sports that are mostly dominated by women. You've seen that because if schools, colleges, high schools did not have some resources that were equal, at least attempts to accommodate and be equal to male sports, there were consequences. In the 1965 Voting Rights Act, we had at the time preclearance provisions. It was amazing that states where there had been deep-seated discrimination against black voters, and I'm using discrimination, it was murder. People who attempted to register to vote were murdered, outright killed in cold blood, murdered. You also had, of course, the literacy tests that prevented people from registering to vote unless they passed a test. Yes, in this country, one had to pass a test. And if you go online, just go online and search for the literacy tests, and I challenge you to try to pass one of them. They are intentionally made to undermine the ability of anyone to actually pass the test. Sometimes the test would be so opaque as to be how many jelly beans are in a jar. You can't take the jelly beans out to count them. No, you have to guesstimate through a mathematical equation based on the size of the jelly bean and the jar how many jelly beans are in the jar. If you have a chance, look at one of the literacy tests that actually asked to write an essay on some provision in either the state or U.S. Constitution. These were the literacy tests they had in place. They had poll taxes. Yes, one had to pay a tax before they could register to vote. And where did you pay the tax? Oh, in the sheriff's office. So can you imagine going to the police department to pay your poll tax? So you're going to the sheriff's office in these towns all around the South to pay your poll tax, which of course is signaling to that sheriff, oh, this is a troublemaker. They actually want to vote. Fannie Lou Hamer, it's a name you should know. This is a black woman in Sunflower, Mississippi. When she registered to vote, when she was finally told she had the ability to vote, because so many in these rural towns, sharecropper families, did not even know they had the right to vote in the 1960s, into the 1960s. When she was told she had a right to vote and she registered, she came home to find her belongings out in the dusty road. She had been evicted off of the land that she had lived on with her family for so long. These are the things that would happen to people until we passed legislation, until the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that you could not do it, until the U.S. Constitution was amended. This is what people had to struggle against. This is what the opposition was, race-based discrimination. And then there were consequences. The Preclearance Clause of the 1965 Voting Rights Act said that a jurisdiction under the control of the Voting Rights Act, those members had to have any changes to their voting laws pre-cleared, overseen by the Department of Justice or a three-judge court before they could make that law, before they could enact it, before they could pass that change, just to make sure that that law was looked over, that proposed law was looked over to see if it had discriminatory effects. This is what allowed the rise of black politicians and other politicians of color, because it wasn't just African Americans. This is what allowed the language changes, so it was only English for so long, so it wasn't only English anymore, so that the ballots were then in Spanish and in Chinese and other languages. This is what gave rise to people of color across the United States being able to run for office. You had federal legislation. The 1968 Fair Housing Act said that you could not discriminate in housing. We used to have provisions within the deeds and the leases. Imagine this, not just in Deep South Mississippi, no, in the Upper East Side of New York. And in the deed and the lease, it said you could not rent or sell the property to a Negro or a Mongolian. A Mongolian was supposed to be Asian, or a Jewish person. They would put this in the deed until the 1968 Fair Housing Act. And of course, the U.S. Supreme Court cases leading up to that over so many decades said, no, you cannot discriminate in housing. If you do, there will be a fine against the one discriminating, because it understood in this legislation that racial discrimination was a fact of life in the United States of America. And we see it even now, and we'll talk more about these voting rights laws across the nation after Donald Trump loses, and then these voting rights laws are voter suppression laws are put in place in order to stop the ability of people to vote freely in the future. So these voter suppression laws are a direct response to the ability of people of color, African Americans, Asians, and others, young people, to stop them from actually using their right to vote. And so therefore, there is national legislation for voting rights that's, you know, proposed, because they gutted the 1965 Voting Rights Act of that preclearance clause. We've talked about that in other shows, and we'll talk about that again. I want us to understand that without national criminal justice reform, we need legislation from Congress that speaks to the racialized history in criminal justice, because our criminal justice is not criminal justice for the people. It was created out of slave catchers. That's where our police department rises from, slave catchers, rises from militia of the 1700s, the 1800s. People profess that our police department began in the 1840s. This is not true. It is an amalgam of sheriff departments and slave catchers and bounty hunters. It has morphed over time with a mixture from England and its system, which actually began as slave catchers over in the islands of the UK. I want us to understand that our criminal justice is, in fact, criminal injustice, and it's been race-based from its very beginning. It is operating exactly as it's supposed to be operating. Therefore, national criminal justice reform is necessary. Take a look at the George Floyd Justice and Policing Bill. It's passed the House in its form and needs to pass the Senate. We have yet to pass any anti-lynching legislation after 200 attempts to pass anti-lynching legislation. That has not passed Congress. We need to understand criminal justice is the issue of the day and shall be. But right now, after this musical message, we'll be back with Dan Quart to discuss his run for Manhattan DA.
Mississippi, surrounded by for world that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong, moving in the right direction, living just enough for the city. Hardly gets a penny, living just enough.
is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall, and we have made a big faux pas. We are speaking with Eliza Orleans, who is running for Manhattan DA, and this is an amazing woman, American lawyer, and television personality. We need to understand that Eliza Orleans is serious about this job. Eliza, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can. So I am looking at your criminal justice background and based on your website, and we know that this is a job in which there's been a lot of competition for Manhattan DA. We understand that the need for a person who's going to see not just what is happening in New York, but what is happening nationally, because this is the most powerful DA's office, we have to say. What is it that you bring to this job?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is such a critical position, and this is truly a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. There has been one transition for the Manhattan DA's office in my lifetime, and we need someone in that office who is deeply committed to bringing about systemic changes. I'm the only person who has spent my entire career as a public defender, and I've gone up against the Manhattan DA's office for the last dozen years. I've represented over 3,000 people charged with crimes, and I've seen how the Manhattan DA's office over-prosecutes and over-incarcerates people for low-level offenses, predominantly, you know, lower-income people, black and brown people, LGBTQIA folks, people with disabilities, and meanwhile turns a blind eye to the crimes committed by those who are wealthy and powerful and well-connected, all while not keeping us safe and wasting taxpayer money. So we need a change.
So here's my concern, and I'm just going to ask you some of the same questions, but I want to speak more to the fact as a public defender, we understand that is the job of defending people who have been charged with a crime. And so when you say that you have been in court over 3,000 times against the prosecutors, is that in Manhattan? Is that across the boroughs? Where are you normally located?
Yeah, I have defended over 3,000 people right here in Manhattan, all against the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. But I've also worked with that office. I've worked with investigators. I'm the only person who's a career public defender, and I've earned the respect of the communities that I've been working to fight for. And I think there's a lot of rebuilding to do, but I have proven consistently that I'm on the right side of that fight, not just in this election, but my whole life.
And there's also so much of the administrative part. Have you held administrative positions? There are over 1,200 DAs or at least personnel within the DA's office in Manhattan. So there's a lot of administrative work to do, too. Do you have that type of background?
Very true. You have to be able to juggle a lot of moving parts as district attorney and as a public defender. You know, I handled thousands of cases, but as many as, you know, close to 200 at once. And for each human being I represented, I managed countless moving parts, you know, teams of investigators and social workers and paralegals. I had to interview expert witnesses, make strategic decisions, and lead these teams, all without ever losing sight of the individual human being and story and circumstances at the heart of each case. And so I've definitely handled lots of thousands of people at once in my role as a public defender, and I'm certainly prepared to lead and make those changes that I know New Yorkers want to see from day one.
One of the issues that I think we've seen many times, and I'm just going to go back, and I'm sure you're very familiar with the history that of the Brooklyn DA's office and Charles Hines, who passed away a few years ago. We had Louis Scarcella, an unethical, we'll say, at the very most, corrupt.
That's should generous be. Of you.
Yes, generous, very generous, corrupt.
Yeah.
Police detective who was a part of dozens of faulty convictions in the Brooklyn DA's office. Charles Hines was the DA of Brooklyn at the time. In his bid for reelection, he lost overwhelmingly, and to Kenneth Thompson. And so in 2014, we had Kenneth Thompson, the first black DA of Brooklyn, come in and begin reforms there, based on the fact that not only had there been over 20 exonerations that came from the time period of Charles Hines's reign as DA, and it was a reign, it was a kingdom in Brooklyn. But what's lost in this, these people's lives had been turned upside down, their reputations, their families destroyed in many ways, irreparable harm has taken place. 20 of them, they found, were this Scarcella used of this drug addicted witness to claim that these crimes had taken place. But the prosecutors were part of this. And the question that comes to my mind and has continued to come to my mind is, what accountability is there for prosecutors? What is the consequence for prosecutors who are corrupt? And that question doesn't seem to get highlighted in any of the websites and the information that the candidates are putting forward. How would you hold prosecutors accountable?
Well, that is a fantastic question. And first of all, let me say that yes, I know that there were 20 exonerations and there should be, you know, dozens, if not hundreds more based on Scarcella's, you know, unethical practices, based on so many of the other people that he worked with who also engaged in these types of practices. You know, there are innocent people sitting in jails and prisons right now due to their misconduct. And, you know, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office has been the same way, has really been complicit in the continuing misconduct of the police. And we're seeing stories right now that, you know, corrupt cops like Detective Franco, and they're dismissing all these cases and pursuing a case against him. But that is the rarity. You know, there are countless stories that I have of police officers who have walked into court, who have lied under oath, you know, swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. They've sworn to tell the truth and then lied under oath. And even when I could show a prosecutor video evidence that this person was lying, the best case scenario was they dismissed the case against my client, and the police officer went on their merry way, as did the prosecutor, who basically suborned perjury. And that is unacceptable. You know, prosecutorial misconduct, police misconduct, these are all things that I have spent my career calling out and fighting back against as a public defender. And I've seen it. I've seen it firsthand. You know, I had one of my most recent trials was the judge had to call a mistrial in the middle of the trial. We'd gotten through the majority of the case and called a mistrial because all of a sudden something came out and it turned out that the prosecutor had lied to the jury, but also to me and to the judge in his opening statement. I mean, this is stuff that just happens so regularly, is so rarely called out. There's so little accountability. And that is something that, you know, is a priority of rooting out the unethical prosecutors in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office when I take over.
My concern. Root them out. How? They're government employees. How do you hold prosecutors accountable? What is your plan for accountability?
So they are at will employees. You know, these are people who you know, if there is found to be misconduct, they should certainly not have the power to bring any future prosecutions, and you know they'll need to find employment elsewhere. You know, I won't hesitate to report people to the bar if they are committing misconduct. Like, this is something that will not stand under my office, because this is something that I have seen firsthand, the way it destroys families and lives. As you said, they've done irreparable harm. Yes, afterwards, an exoneration, of course, is great, but the harm was done years, if not decades ago, and people's lives were destroyed. Their families were torn apart. You know, you need to make sure this doesn't happen up front. So there needs to be, you know, accountability immediately. And that's why I've proposed, you know, a very detailed data transparency and accountability unit, where there will be opportunities for people to even anonymously report prosecutors who are not living up to the standards and values that I have set for that office.
And with police officers, and I know most of the criminal justice reform is focused on policing, but a police officer can only be held accountable if there is a law that the police officer has broken and the prosecutors prosecute. So that prosecutorial discretion is something that has become a major issue. It should be highlighted all of the time because most people don't understand you cannot change the law if prosecutors still have the discretion as to whether or not they're going to prosecute under that law. And that's the missing piece here. Police officers know they're not supposed to kill people. They know they're not supposed to brutalize people. They know basically what the Constitution says they are to do and not to do. Yet they don't have to follow the law if the prosecutors, in their discretion, decide they are not going to press for the law to be applied to them. There's this issue around immunity. And if you don't mind just telling our listeners the level of immunity prosecutors have, and then what you propose to do with that immunity if you are the DA.
Well, so prosecutors make decisions every day as to which cases they should be bringing and not bringing. You know, the idea that prosecutors have to in some way enforce the law is just this fallacy that people have. Oh, the law exists, the prosecutors must prosecute. But they make decisions every day about who to prosecute and who not to prosecute. And those decisions typically mean that the things that I've seen as a public defender, which is the over-prosecution of the people like the people I've represented, you know, predominantly lower-income folks and Black and brown people and you know, people from other marginalized communities, are the people who are over-prosecuted, and meanwhile, anyone with power, wealth, connection, you know, doesn't get prosecuted. And that means and includes law enforcement. And so law enforcement is typically not held accountable, and the DA's office really doesn't prosecute for perjury, doesn't prosecute for, you know, the brutality that we see, the, you know, physical assault and violence and harassment we see in the streets. And doesn't prosecute for the falsifying of documents. I mean, every time you sign a criminal complaint, it says on the bottom, you know, you're signing this under penalty of perjury. And yet there's never any consequence to that. And so, you know, there have to be, even when there can't be a criminal case brought by the DA's office, you know, the district attorney should be advocating for changes that will happen legislatively so that there can be more accountability. You know, we know that the CCRB, the Civilian Complaint Review Board, has no teeth. You know, there's very little that they can do to hold the police accountable. And so even if the DA's office can't charge a crime, there's still more that the DA can be doing with the bully pulpit of the Manhattan DA's office to fight for police accountability and to be proactive and to release, you know, information, including lists of police officers who have been found to have lied or found to have committed misconduct. And New Yorkers have the right to know. They have the right to know who's coming into their communities. They have the right to know who is, you know, engaging in these types of practices. And that's something that I have been, you know, very outspoken about and that I will be very transparent about.
And just to be clear, prosecutors have immunity. That's what allows them to do their jobs. Government employees have immunity. Police officers have a qualified immunity. This immunity says that they cannot be prosecuted. They cannot have actions against them in civil court based on doing their jobs. They are covered, protected in this immunity. They're immune from the civil liability and unless they have stepped outside of their protection of the color of law. What we have, though, in certain states, Colorado and of course here in New York, is a change in these immunity laws. So here we now have this question going into a DA's office as powerful as a Manhattan DA. What changes in immunities would you propose if you were the Manhattan DA? Would you be in opposition to a change in immunity for prosecutors once you become a prosecutor?
No, of course not. It's so funny. I was being interviewed the other day and a reporter said to me, Eliza, you realize you say the word prosecutor with a bit of disdain, like you realize what position you're running for, right? And it's because I have fought back against prosecutors my entire career. So I'm not going in there to, like, be a good prosecutor or then start becoming complicit in protecting prosecutors who destroy people's lives. You know, prosecutorial misconduct is rampant. We should certainly be ending prosecutorial immunity, because when prosecutors have these egregious violations of the law, when they hide exculpatory evidence, I mean, this is shameful and tragic, and it destroys human beings' lives. And for them not to face consequences for that is, you know, it's deplorable. It doesn't effectuate justice. It is, you know, it actually, like, laughs in the face of the word justice. It's so troubling, and there must be, it's far past time to create accountability for prosecutors as well.
We're speaking with Eliza Orleans. Eliza Orleans, running for Manhattan District Attorney, and her website is ElizaOrleans.com, O-R-L-I-N-S. ElizaOrleans.com. I'm looking at your website right now, and in looking at the policies, and especially the unit that you had proposed, conviction review unit, what exactly would it do?
So a lot of these conviction review units that we are seeing pop up around the country are ones where they're focused on undoing harms, you know, exoneration years or decades after the damage has been done. And while that is an incredibly important and noble goal, my conviction review unit would be groundbreaking in that it would be expanding the definition of wrongful conviction, because we have to take a broader view of what a wrongful conviction is, you know, something, a sentence that is wrongful, something that is undue or unfair or unequal. And we need to proactively ensure that these cases are not, you know, existing in the first place, that we are not allowing people to be wrongfully convicted. And so, you know, having this conviction review unit that has data scientists and statisticians and people who are analyzing every case that comes through and examining these cases and monitoring incoming charges, making sure that there is complete independence of my unit, so that they can step in at any point in the process to make sure that we are not doing anything that is unjust or wrongful, because I think this is something that is so critical and is so past due, and really being transparent, fully transparent with that data is incredibly important as well.
Traditionally, one goes into the prosecutor's office, learns the trade on the dime of the government, and then becomes defense counsel. You're going the other way. Why is that?
You know, I never thought I'd be anything other than a public defender. It was the reason I went to law school. It was the only job I applied for. It's what I anticipated doing for life. I've never worked as a prosecutor and never aspired to be one, but really, kind of over the last dozen years, like, my frustration and anger and heartbreak about the way the criminal legal system operates has certainly grown, but also the national conversation has shifted in such a major way to the point where we really are talking about how we can shrink the footprint of the district attorney's office, how we can undo the harm that prosecutors have perpetrated for so long. And the last thing we need is another career prosecutor to come in and continue to uphold mass incarceration and be the primary driver of incarcerating people of color at these disproportionate numbers. We need someone who's going to go in there and bring about the real transformational change we need to see to bring the Manhattan DA's office to the right side of history. This is so long overdue. This is, you know, an unbelievably critical election, and it's something that the person who's best suited to actually bring about these changes, to understand the nuances with regards to how criminal court operates, you know, to have the litigation experience and the knowledge of how these cases are actually brought, but also who has been authentically committed to these issues for their entire career, is only a public defender. And I'm the only public defender running for Manhattan DA. And that's why, you know, I am the best suited to take over this office if people want to see real change.
And I'm going to circle back to prosecutorial misconduct because it is the glaring issue that for some reason seems to be such a bright light history, part of this. And historically, because police officers are the focal point, they're the ones we actually see, we think that just changing the policies around policing will be enough. Where the prosecutors failed to prosecute for generations. And that's why we have the police departments we have today. They work hand in glove. Prosecutorial misconduct under your proposed administration would result in what? Let's be very clear. Tell us how you would handle prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, this is, this is an issue that I have called out for my entire career, and I really appreciate you bringing this back up because, you know, prosecutors get away with misconduct, including hiding and withholding exculpatory evidence, which results in wrongful convictions. And in those circumstances, they should be prosecuted. They should be prosecuted for obstructing justice. I mean, it should go way beyond losing their jobs and losing their law license, but there should be civil consequences and potentially even criminal consequences for misconduct. You know, people love to use the phrase, no one is above the law. And yet when prosecutors commit misconduct, this is something that they get to just say. They get to look back and say, I was just doing my job. And it's really incumbent upon our elected district attorneys to make sure that the people who serve under them are not doing this. You know, horrendous prosecutors who are putting people in jail should not be the exception. You know, people who are throwing innocent people in jail, hiding evidence, should not be the exception to the notion that no one is above the law. Prosecutors are also not above the law. And, you know, what is happening in certain states, admirably, that they are starting to do away with this immunity, absolute immunity for prosecutors is something that's incredibly important. And I hope New York follows suit.
And there has been proposed legislation, state legislation, and that will probably take root again as we go forward, focused on prosecutors. Absolute immunity is what I was waiting for you to actually address this issue, that prosecutors have absolute immunity. Police have qualified immunity. Can you imagine that we do not have an ability at this point to prosecute the prosecutors who are using their discretion to ruin the lives of others? And I'm not saying all prosecutors are bad. I'm saying that, yes, just like police departments, plumbers, and teachers, you have these people who have the power to ruin the lives of others and get away with it. How would you like to end our conversation? What is it that you want people to know and why they should vote for you in these last seconds together?
Well, I appreciate that. And I think that, you know, the person who you can trust to bring about these desperately needed changes is a public defender. You know, I have spent my entire career fighting against these issues with our criminal legal system that's cruel, that's unjust, that's inhumane, that destroys families and lives, and that's not keeping us safe. You know, I have the authentic commitment to bringing about these transformational changes. I think people have to be honest with themselves about what it means to stand with a former prosecutor. The majority of my opponents are people who spent their lives prosecuting and locking people up mostly for low-level offenses or nonviolent offenses. And, you know, even if they're now making progressive promises, so did Cy Vance when he ran at first too, and he didn't keep those promises. So we need to make sure that we elect someone who has the experience to understand the implications of her policies in the real world and who's ready to bring about these bold systemic changes. I am that person. I can do those things, and I would be honored to receive people's support as the next Manhattan District Attorney.
Thank you, Eliza Orleans. And this is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. We've been speaking with Manhattan DA candidate Eliza Orleans and her push for the office of DA. Thank you so much. This is Law of the Land. We'll, yes, and we'll be right back with your calls. We want to hear from you. So the number to call, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. What do you think of Eliza Orleans? What do you think of her platform for Manhattan DA? 212-209-2877. After this musical break, we'll be right back. This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. And, of course, that was the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin. Call me, and hopefully you're calling me so that we can have a discussion about Eliza Orleans and her bid for Manhattan DA. You're on the line. This is Law of the Land. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Hi. I'm calling from upstate New York. We live on top of a mountain, so we're actually able to get your signal from up here. I'm calling because I've been worried about prosecutorial misconduct for a long time. And I think the issue that Liza Orleans is not addressing is that DAs have to work hand-in-hand with police. And it's going to be very difficult for them to turn in a cop. And they rely on that cop to bring them cases and bring them good cases. I would suggest this. I would think that we need a separate division in the Department of Justice, really, to prosecute all cops and take that out of the hands of the local DAs. I mean, that's why no cops are ever brought up for murder unless they're caught on tape, as happened recently. I think we need, a federal division of the Department of Justice that would handle every instance where a policeman kills anybody. And many of them will be exonerated because they did nothing wrong. They were doing their job. But the ones who weren't, who were actually committing murder, would be prosecuted federally.
I think that's a brilliant idea. What we have so far in New York State, as you may well know, is a special prosecutor who is brought in to prosecute law enforcement in cases, very specific cases, in which law enforcement police-involved civilian shooting, and the person who was shot is unarmed. That is the very particularized area in which a special prosecutor could be brought in to try that case. That's only in New York State, and that is through Governor Cuomo. So we don't know when the next governor comes in if they're going to repeal that law and put in something else or nothing at all. So that's why national criminal justice reform is necessary. But I think that would be an excellent provision.
Good. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. I told you I have the smartest listeners of all the programs. And I do believe that's a great idea, because right now it's true. The law enforcement officers and the DA work hand in glove. The police officers bring in the evidence. They find the witnesses. They run the test, the ballistics test, fingerprints, everything else. They are the ones that do the footwork. They are out there in the community. That's why we see them more than we even understand, except for the Law and Order shows like that, what prosecutors even do. So it's very rare that you see a Law and Order program with a corrupt prosecutor. I don't think I've seen one. And I think we need to understand there are corrupt prosecutors, just like there are corrupt plumbers and corrupt mechanics and, you know, corrupt teachers. So I think that it's important for us to understand that it is a difficult situation for prosecutors to have to prosecute these people they know as Joe or Marty or Sam, when they know that this person now is being accused of abusing a civilian or taking a civilian life. But let's go to the next caller. This is Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall. Good morning.
Good morning.
And how are you? Do you have a comment on Eliza Orleans?
Are you talking to me?
Yes, I am. I am talking to you live on the air. Please say what you have to say.
Oh, that's wonderful. My name is Ken, and I'm happy to be on the line. And I want to thank you very much for providing, first of all, you know, the opportunity for us to hear the candidates that are running and get in the questions you were asking. Very, very insightful. I thought it was very interesting. And I'm also a supporter of WBAI.
Now, thank you.
In listening to the questions you were asking, before we hang up too, or before you finish your program, if you can give the spelling of the candidate again, so that, you know, those of us, we can have her name written, spelled properly. I thought that when you asked her, because I heard you ask specifically, what would she do? Now, you know, I thought maybe she didn't want to say specifically so as to maybe, you know, let someone else know, whatever. It's a very tough kind of situation. I don't think she actually came out and said specifically what she would do, but who knows, that might be her own personal trade secrets about what she intends to do. But the idea of a defense attorney who witnesses some of the obstacles and the complicated things and some of the injustices, et cetera, and unethical behavior on the part of prosecutors, that would give them a pretty good standing, you know, if they are sincere. So the idea of a defense attorney maybe being a prosecutor might be a good idea. It could help solve the problem. And then I'll hang up and listen, okay?
Oh, thank you so much. I think it is a very unusual stance, but it is a stance from someone who has witnessed prosecutorial discretion, prosecutorial abuse, who's gone up against the prosecutors. I'm concerned about the lack of administrative experience, but Cyrus Vance didn't have administrative experience, and there are many people who are part of the entity called the DA's office who will do the work that's necessary to keep the administration going, or at least to help the person who comes in at the top job understand the ins and outs of a business. That's about how it happens anywhere. When we take on a new job, we all learn from the people who are there. I am concerned about the fact that these candidates have not thought about prosecutorial misconduct and what ways in which these prosecutors are to be held accountable. As I've said many times, the law is what the law is, but if a prosecutor's decline to press the law when it comes to police officers, then we have police officers acting with impunity and no real accountability. Her name is Eliza Orleans, E-L-I-Z-A, Eliza Orleans, O-R-L-I-N-S. The listener is right. We want to make sure these names are correct. Dan Court is next week. He will be the one who was interviewed, the next candidate we have in our sights for this office of Manhattan DA. And just to let you know, the Manhattan DA's office has a budget the size of a corporation, of a major corporation. We're talking about a huge entity here in the Manhattan DA's office. The policies are policies that then are taken on by smaller DA offices and other ones around the country. They set the tone, and so it's very important for us to understand that this office is not just one small office, and it's just for Manhattan, and that's why it's so important for all of us to know what is going on with the Manhattan DA, and especially in this race. I don't know if we have time for any other calls. Do we have another caller on the line? Yes, very quickly. Good morning. This is Law of the Land.
Hello?
Yes, good morning. We only have a few moments.
Thank you very much. My name is Chris. I'm calling from Manhattan. And I would just, I'd like you to ask these candidates about what they're going to do about white-collar corporate crime. Now, someone with the last name of Feinstein, I know her husband, I read in the New York Times, is very big in Wall Street. And she's taken all of these donations from Wall Street. And I think it's very important that that white-collar people be prosecuted. And I mean, they're the ones who have the power in their hands, right? If you could ask them in the future specifically what they'll do about that. Okay?
That sounds great. Thank you. Thank you so much, and that, and I will do that. That's what makes WBAI so special, is that, one, as I told you, I believe Law of the Land has the smartest listeners, but also that we are interacting. We're in a relationship. We're trying to do the best for the community, and that community is writ large, is large as we want it to be, not just the New York community, the region, but because of WBAI.org, the archive shows that we are heard around the country and in different parts of the world. So I thank you for that question, and I will put it forward for the next candidates who are interviewed on this program. And as we come to the end of this program, if you do have a question that you would like me to ask, then please send it to G.B. Marshall, B for Brown, Marshall with two L's, G.B. Marshall at WBAI.org. Yes, G.B. Marshall at WBAI.org. I'd like to hear from you. And if you could and would or have the time, please become a WBAI buddy. I'm drinking my coffee and tea, of course, out of my WBAI mug. Today I'm having tea. So if you would, then donate and receive your WBAI mug, and we can drink our tea, coffee, whatever beverage we want it to be in the mornings together. But support the station and all the great programs that we have here. And if you have a chance, my new book is She Took Justice, The Black Woman, Law, and Power. I think it would make a great Mother's Day gift. She Took Justice, The Black Woman, Law, and Power. That is my new book. And if you have a chance to pick it up, I would appreciate it. And just know that it's published by Routledge and that there is a discount code that you can use and you can get 20% off. So keep that in mind as well. There's so much in this world to know about, and Black Women, Law, and Power. I think it's a very interesting book, but also learn about the history of Black women. The discount code is FLR40. F is in Frank, L is in Larry, R is in Richard, FLR40. That's on the Routledge website. 20% off with a discount. She Took Justice, The Black Woman, Law, and Power. I'm saying goodbye to you, but just until the next time, because you know I want to. Please take care of yourself. Thank you, Michael G., and I'll see you on the radio. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree.
It's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
Did you know that if you brush your teeth with your right hand and then you switch to your left hand, it can help your brain? That tip and others are presented on WBAI Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. on May 4th, when we bring you a forum presented by